I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. In the last few years, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, and the military ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Most states and Washington, D.C. have legalized same-sex marriage, and the rest of the states could follow suit if the U.S. Supreme Court strikes down bans on same-sex marriage nationwide, a case that they will hear next week. And ask any pollster about public opinion about LGBT equality, and they'll tell you that public opinion has shifted dramatically, with majorities favoring equal rights. Our guest, Michelangelo Signorelli, acknowledges these victories but worries that complacency and something he calls victory blindness could be setting in. He writes in his new book, It's Not Over, that gays and lesbians are still denied basic rights and protections in many states. For instance, the hate crime law in Pennsylvania does not cover gays and lesbians, and you can be fired from your job if you are LGBT in the Commonwealth. Michelangelo Signorelli joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. He's editor-at-large of Huffington Post Gay Voices, also the host of the Michelangelo Signorelli Show. It airs each weekday on Sirius XM Progress. That's channel 127, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I should add that you can hear Radio Times on the NPR channel 122. Michelangelo Signorelli, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is victory blindness?
It's something that I began to note, a phenomenon I began to note as I saw a lot of the celebrations of victory over the last few years, and saw that both LGBT leaders, some in the community, as well as the media, were looking at these achievements and then beginning to use the word inevitable about full equality. Of course, marriage is something very important, but as you just pointed out about Pennsylvania, 29 states, no protections with discrimination as in housing, or public accommodations, be thrown out of a restaurant, a shop, no federal laws, and that's just the beginning. There's the culturally embedded homophobia and transphobia. So I started to see that idea, that inevitable word, and that leads to the apathy, but it also leads to a different tactic we start to see, where people start saying, we should be magnanimous and gracious in our wins and be less confrontational because, you know, now these poor people who persecuted us all this while, they're the losers now.
Maybe they even like us?
Yes. And I just think that's a trap because it allows the backlash to begin. And I think we've seen that with other groups. So I'm saying let's learn from other groups.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what has changed. And how much do you think just people coming out has changed just how other people see gays and lesbians, and how much you think there is growing support for equality?
There's no question that we've seen dramatic, dizzying change in the past few years. And coming out is enormously important. Every study that's done shows that people who know people who are gay are more likely to support gay rights. Certainly people coming out in their own families have changed their own families, their parents or others in their families. So that has been certainly a catalyst for a lot of this change. And I think that we need to continue that.
Making it a safe, I mean, the more people that are out, the safer it is to then to come out?
The more people out, the more others feel comfortable, and particularly when people in public life are out, the more the society in general feels like, well, there are a lot of gay people, and it's my next door neighbor, but it's also this television star that I really like, and it's this one, and it's that one, it's my cousin, and it's my daughter, and they really do start to change their minds.
This goes back a couple of decades, but you were very active in outing a number of people, including Malcolm Forbes, Pete Williams, and there was some pushback, some backlash that you got. Fran Lebowitz, I think she called you a terrorist.
That's right.
She called this immoral. Why was it important? I can understand outing people who are true hypocrites and have power. You outed Malcolm Forbes actually after he had died.
Right. The entire issue, I think, especially at the time, was so distorted by much of the media. It was Time magazine that came up with this word, outing. I was simply putting out there in the middle of the most horrific epidemic we had experienced in this country, and certainly the gay community, after finally finding its voice.
This is AIDS, of course.
Seeing ourselves being decimated, yes, and seeing such an intolerance and indifference, intolerance by a right-wing government, indifference by the media and others, and seeing people dying, and it was urgent that people be out, and it was urgent that we, as we just discussed, show the public that very prominent people are gay. And so I began to write about that in my column in Outweek. And I really was critiquing the media and saying, you should be reporting on it when it is relevant to a larger story. I had been a publicist before that, and we used to actually heterosexualize the gay and lesbian actors. We would have to tell the truth about everything else to the gossip columnists and whatnot, but we'd match up the gay actors with straight with someone of the opposite gender and sort of heterosexualize them. So I started to say, look, we need to have this equalization in the media. That was called, I mean, when Malcolm Forbes died, I said, well, you know, they're all going to report for history that this man who was a right-wing icon of the, you know, economic right-wing principles was Elizabeth Taylor's boyfriend. I need to write the story. It was Time magazine that decided, and I would later find out it was a closeted bisexual man. His wife wrote me, William Henry III, who coined the term, and it's a violent active verb. I just saw it as reporting.
Well, and we could do a whole hour on this.
Yeah.
Actually, 25 years ago, we probably did two whole hours on this. But I guess there's one thing to sort of out yourself, and it's another thing for someone to out somebody else, especially when it involves their private life. And if they're not hurting somebody and just living their private life, can't they be left alone?
Well, I think when it comes to people of enormous privilege and the glass closet, which is very different than someone who is deeply closeted and, you know, is married to somebody of the opposite gender, not bisexual, and sort of having sex on the side or whatever. This glass closet are people who are known to be gay. Everybody around them knows they're gay. They socialize in the gay community. Everybody in the media knows they're gay, but nobody talks about it. And I think with those people, why not? What's wrong with being gay? Rosie O'Donnell and I did a town hall at Sirius XM a couple of weeks ago where she interviewed me, and I was honored to do it on the book. But we have quite a history because
yes, you do.
I was pressuring her. And she said to me, you know, you did the right thing, because between Ellen DeGeneres coming out and you pressuring me, you both influenced me. It was one was an inspirational story one way. One was a guy who was a pain in the neck. But one way or another, it needed to be done. I needed to come out. And that pressure was good.
But it was her decision.
Right. It was her decision in the end. But there were those of us who were pushing her and saying, come on, Rosie. Everybody knows you talk about it, but you talk about this, you're out with this one, you're out with that one. I mean, we used to see the media photographing Jodie Foster with her children, and there'd be this woman in the background, and they'd never say who the woman was. But if that was a man, they would tell you who that was. And you better believe if it was somebody she was sleeping with, they would tell you every detail about it. That, to me, is a media double standard.
What was it like for you to come out?
It was, you know, that process that you come to terms with it from a very young age. I was 8 years old when I realized that I was gay. And through my teen years, I was sexually active, but also tormented about the whole idea and wanting to be straight and wanting to do whatever I could. Certainly had the suicidal thoughts.
Did you really?
Absolutely. And it wasn't until I went to college and really sort of got away from home that I became more comfortable. But it wasn't really until I got involved with ACT UP and really sort of saw this from the political perspective of what it does that I really came out to everyone in my life in a big way and realized how important it was.
Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in a number of states, these RFRA, as they're known, these RFRA laws, Indiana, Mike Pence. Bobby Jindal has a piece in the New York Times today. Of course, the governor of Louisiana, He writes in this piece, our country was founded on the principle of religious liberty enshrined in the Bill of Rights. Why shouldn't an individual or business have the right to cite in a court proceeding religious liberty as a reason for not participating in same-sex marriage ceremony that violates a sincerely held religious belief? And here we are talking about people making cakes for weddings.
Right.
And how do you reconcile this?
Well, I saw a lot of this building as I was researching my book and going to the Conservative Political Action Conference, the Values Voters Summit. These are the laboratories where anti-gay forces sort of put together the ways they're going to blunt gay rights. And they had been talking for a while. What happens if the Supreme Court does rule in favor of marriage equality? They don't use that term. But, you know, same-sex marriage or not traditional marriage. And they talked about the various things they would need to do. And religious liberties bills and conscience clauses. I think we're going to see this term quite a bit, too. And we've seen it with the reproductive rights movement. You know, the pharmacist who shouldn't have to serve a woman contraception or the morning after pill, right? So they were talking about those things. And they were talking about how, you know, we in the LGBT movement, I think too many in the media, look at the larger picture and see them as, oh, they did something and they lost and that's that. They see it as, oh, we had a trial balloon. It didn't work. Let's go back to the laboratory. So Arizona, they tried to pass one of these bills. Governor Jan Brewer vetoed it. We all thought, aha, we won. They said, no, let's go back and retool it. Mm-hmm. And so they went back, retooled, and obviously Indiana and Arkansas was another shot at it. This with Bobby Jindal, he's trying to make it specifically about wedding cakes and specifically about marriage in particular so that he can get away from Governor Pence's dilemma of any business. And, you know, a recent poll the AP did showed that 57% of people, even many who support marriage equality, mm-hmm. believe a baker should be able to not serve a cake to a gay couple. So there's the education we need to do, and they're finding that wedge.
And what's the answer back to that person who says the baker has a right not to make a cake for a gay wedding about a minute before our first
The answer is you're a public business and you are open to the public. If you were just working in a church and baking for Christians in the church, that's one thing. But if you're open to the public, you have to serve everybody. Nobody is infringing your speech. There's nothing – none of these cases, by the way, have ever been about what gets written on the cake. They don't even get to the point of the cake being baked. Most wedding cakes don't have anything on them. So it's not even about speech. I think you would have the right not to put – and there have been, you know, some challenges by Christians to put on the cake – you know, something like, I'm opposed to marriage equality, and bakers have said no, but that's a speech issue. This is simply about serving people.
And about public comment. I mean,
right.
It is in, because it's about a business.
Open to the public.
To the public.
And once you open that door to not allowing based on one thing, well, then it'll be on another thing and another thing and another thing. And then it'll be beyond bakers. It'll be a restaurant that says, well, I don't like these two people coming in. They were holding hands. And I don't like that. So I don't want to serve those people.
That's Michelangelo Signorelli, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He has a new book. It's got a big title, It's Not Over. And it's subtitled Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, talking with Michelangelo Signorelli about his new book. It's called It's Not Over. He's the editor-at-large of Huffington Post Gay Voices, also the host of the Michelangelo Signorelli Show. You can hear on Sirius XM Progress. We do 2 hours a day. He does 3 hours a day. So this is absolutely nothing for him. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You go to CPAC. You go to the Values Forum. I mean, I think for some people, they just think, I'm going to stay away from these people. But you go, why? Because you want to learn, you want to talk?
I think it is important to engage with the people and study the people who are opposing my rights and trying to take away my rights, and bring that to my listeners who are really concerned about that. Certainly, I think it also helps a lot of people when they hear me debating with these people to debate with their own family about these issues. So I do like to go and engage, and to also see how they're organizing, because often a lot of the media reporting from these events, they get on a certain narrative that sort of omits a lot of what's happening in the dark corners of these events.
But I mean, can you, from your experience and from your conversation, say that these are people who truly believe what they say, you know, are well-intentioned, don't want you any harm? They just happen to believe what they believe?
I think most of the people are true believers, and they believe that their religious freedoms are under attack, and that the gay movement is somehow part of that. They also very much, are pro-life and anti-abortion. They sort of, on many issues, they are very much, Christian evangelical based. And they, in that sense, are genuine in their beliefs. They're often misinformed, uninformed about issues, don't understand. I mean, at one event, they were talking about how we need to get protections for Christians. And I said, well, you do have protections. It's in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, protection based on religion. there's sort of this victimology that goes on. There's that group, and then there's the leaders. And the leaders know what the deal is, and particularly those in the Republican Party, but even the ones who run the major groups themselves know that they're often exploiting people who are misinformed and who are filled up with fear.
I also get the feeling that you are, maybe critical is too strong a word, but have perhaps some problems with organizations like the Human Rights Campaign or some of these more mainstream Washington, D.C., inside the Beltway organizations. True? Not true?
Yes, very true. I have been very critical because I think that there is, well, it's hard to even begin because I have a number of criticisms.
Okay,
but
go ahead.
I think just to boil it down, they have been a part of, I think, creating this victory narrative because they like to focus on wins. They don't like to have a loss. It's not good for fundraising. It is not good to look to the politicians like you lost something when you're lobbying on the Hill. And they see rights as a Hill sort of lobbying thing rather than changing hearts and minds out there. There's not a connection to the grassroots of the movement that really is about trying to engage people and change people on the ground. So I've always had a problem with that strategy. And they also believe in this incremental strategy with legislation. You know, we were pushing for 20 years for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, a narrow employment bill with religious exemptions that would allow the very people who want to discriminate to discriminate. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when you ask for only a little bit, you're not taken seriously as a movement. You need to ask for full equality.
Well, it's interesting to think about the kind of activism that you have been involved in and to think about legislation. And, of course, the courts as well have played such a big role. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to take up this issue of these bans on same-sex marriages across the country. Do you have any read or feel on how they're going to rule on that?
It's been pretty extraordinary to see what's gone on with the marriage movement and to see the speed with which it's sort of picked up just in the last year. And it's clear that the court, by allowing these lower court rulings to stand and allowing so many more people to get married, is intent on ruling in favor of marriage equality. At least that's – I talk to lawyers all day long, and that's what they say all the time on my program. The question is with what legal theory they'll do it and how narrow it will be, and will it be a 5-4, or will they try to bring in John Roberts? Of course, Justice Kennedy has been the linchpin, but will they try to bring in John Roberts, and will that narrow it so that it is based on the lowest standard and will be difficult for it to apply to all these other things like Baker's and everything else? Because if it's not heightened scrutiny, then it's not at the same level as race. then we are going to be at the court many times over, over many issues.
I think it's interesting. This goes back a number of years on the Lawrence ruling that it was Justice Scalia in a dissent basically kind of predicted that by bypassing Lawrence, it would inevitably eventually take the court to this issue of marriage.
It's fascinating, and that has actually been used by
some. And he wasn't happy about it.
No, but his dissent has been used by some of the judges who ruled in favor of marriage equality. Some of these federal judges have actually said, well, Justice Scalia has said this, and we agree with him. So, yeah, he was right about that, and I think he may want – the conservatives on the court may actually want Justice Roberts to move in with supporters of marriage equality to narrow the decision.
I mean, it's interesting. We're talking about – we haven't really talked about, but serving in the military, getting married. I mean, in many ways, those are conservative things. I mean, they are – there's nothing wrong with them. But it's the sort of traditional thing to do. Do you think that has been helpful, hurtful to the gay movement?
I think it's been a great thing. And I think what's been great about it is that it's been grassroots driven. Getting back to this criticism with the Beltway groups, you know, they had this plan, like this 20-year plan that they were going to pass ENDA, which they've tried to pass for 20 years, that Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and that they were going to do it, you know, slowly and incrementally and try to get in the back door kind of thing and, you know, lobby on the Hill. And it was average everyday people. The marriage movement goes back to Hawaii and couples who said, we need this and we think our state will do this. And you know, they were a rural, mixed race lesbians of very little means. Who one of the couples, another couple, a gay male couple. They were like, "We need, you know, our rights." So, the marriage movement to me was very grassroots driven with legal advocates like Evan Wolfson and others. Don't ask, don't tell. People were being thrown out of the military. Their lives were being destroyed. That took precedent, and the Washington groups had to sort of catch up. But at first, with marriage, they were horrified by this marriage movement. They said there would be a backlash, and they didn't organize around it.
And there, I mean,
they were right. There was a backlash, but sometimes you need the backlash. You know, DOMA was passed, but they sort of were so freaked out about it that instead of dealing with that, dealing with how our enemies were organizing, maybe getting Bill Clinton to respond in a different way. I mean, it's called coulda, shoulda, woulda. But the point is that they weren't of that mindset that, yeah, you need to pick a fight in order to win a battle. They were in this mindset of, let's try to slowly, while nobody's looking, get rights. And I don't think that works.
You say in this book that when New York legalized same-sex marriage, I guess that was 2011, that was the highest year for the number of gay murders. I mean, in a sense, making a connection between these two. Do you think that's cause and effect?
It was also the highest year. This is another extraordinary figure. A 40% increase in 2011 when New York passed marriage equality in homeless youth in New York City, a 40% jump. And a lot of people believe that youth advocates believe kids saw, oh, wow, there's gay marriage. I'm going to come out of the closet now. And yet they had parents who were not accepting. And it's an extraordinary thing to think. And homeless youth, 40% of them are LGBT. So that gives you nationwide. It gives you another window into this. But yes, there has been a backlash to the visibility. There always is a backlash to the visibility. And again, this victory blindness, people don't look at that. And it often hurts the most marginalized parts of our community, people who don't have resources, gay people of color, transgender people, transgender women of color have been murdered by a rate of 3-1 compared to other gay, lesbian, bisexual people. So it all gets kind of covered up in a sense when we're on this victory blindness, with victory narrative, excuse me.
Victory narrative. And I do want to get to our callers, and we have some comments as well. Just one more thing that you say in the book, and this is about Mississippi. You say 80%, or there's been some research to say that 80% of gay men are in the closet in Mississippi. And I just wonder, how do you do research on that?
Really amazing stuff. And some of the research I have in the book really new stuff on both implicit bias and how it's just been a slight change compared to explicit bias. And then also the closet. Seth Stevens Davidowitz is a Google data scientist, and he uses very interesting data sets looking at Match.com, Craigslist ads, Facebook, and all kinds of other online data sets where people are putting so much information out there. And he was able to determine that, you know, for example, in Mississippi, and he's also determined that there's roughly the same percentage of gay men everywhere. It's been believed that people move to San Francisco or New York. He determined that actually it's not as big as people think. And that looking at Mississippi, there's a higher percentage of Craigslist ad looking for, sex on the side by married men than in New York. In New York, there's a higher percentage of Match.com ads of people looking for relationships. And then the question on Google, how do I know if my husband is gay, is the number one thing that women ask about their husband. The second is, how do I know if my husband is cheating? But the first is, how do I know if my husband is gay?
This is in Mississippi.
Nationally. How do I know if my husband is gay is number one. But the number one state is South Carolina, and then Louisiana, then Mississippi, then Alabama. So, you know, he starts to put that all together. And why do so many women in Mississippi think their husbands are gay? And why are there so many more? And he was able to determine then looking at Facebook, because on Facebook you can see, it's not anonymous. You can determine whether people are out or not and who identifies as gay, because you can identify as gay. And he was able to determine that nationally, roughly 50% or a little more of gay men were open. But in Mississippi, 80% of those who were gay were closeted, and many of them married to women and not bisexual.
And that's Michelangelo Signorelli. His new book is called It's Not Over, and it's subtitled Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. Let me get to some callers at 1-888-477-9499. I see some comments as well, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Bruce from Perkasie to join us. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Another amazing show, Marty.
Thanks.
And thank you for having me.
Sure.
Michelangelo, sir, I am with you 100%. I think victory blindness is a brilliant term, smacking of the fallacies of a post-racial society.
Right.
I love everything you're saying. But I think I have a flaw in your argument that I'm worried about finding a defense to.
Go ahead.
I operate a karate school in Perkasie, and my job is to bring esteem and confidence to people, regardless of their position in life. So I deal with children and slender people and people that have been bullied and so forth. And karate can be a boys' club where people come in and, they're tough guys and we learn to fight. And I love that aspect of it, too. But you can get more than your fair share of belligerence in there. So when people walk in and they want to prove how tough they are, they don't get to play in my playground. And my concern is that line you drew that said when a place, a private business, opens for the public, that they need to be open to anyone. And I am the only arbiter, I'm the sole arbiter of what I consider to be objectionable behavior. My concern is that my argument could be used by a restaurateur that'll say, well, this couple came in holding hands, I serve a chiefly Christian clientele, it's going to turn their stomachs during the dinner hour, their behavior is objectionable. So how do I, I'd go to court.
Well, hold on, Bruce. Hold on.
Bruce, your question and what you've just explained is fascinating for two reasons. I'm going to explain both. One, that it slightly diverges. On the question that you just asked about serving people, businesses have a wide, right to not serve people, and you have a right not to serve people who are behaving a certain way. Businesses can say you cannot wear sandals in our shop, our restaurant. You have to wear a jacket. You have to wear a tie. If there is a policy that is uniform to everyone, you have every right. You also have a right not to serve loud people, boisterous people. You can throw people out if they're loud.
Sure.
So that would apply to what you're saying. But you can't not serve people based on protected classes. And in the places we've seen where these cases have come up, gay and transgender people are protected under law in Oregon, in Colorado, and elsewhere. But I do want to address something else he said.
Sure.
I have a whole chapter in the book on self-defense and what to do with children and the terrible problem of suicide among LGBT people. 40% of teen suicides are LGBT kids. We've seen the reports. And empowering kids. And I talk about self-defense because it's what I did as a kid when I was talking earlier.
But your dad kind of
taught me how,
to
fight.
Fight.
And I talked to a number of, and on my show, I had a lot of people call up who in self-defense training and asked also a lot of gay people to call and talk about how they fought back. So I am totally with you on what you're doing in your business as well, because I think it really helps to build self-esteem, and it's a great thing for LGBT people to do.
Bruce, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You also have a really interesting section where you draw on some of the work of a writer who wrote a book about passing and covering. You seem to be saying that it's important for gay people to not try to be like straight people, if I can put it that way.
Yes.
To sort of downplay the importance is there are differences and we shouldn't try to cover them up.
Yes. Kenji Yoshino wrote a book called Covering back in 2006, which looked at how all marginalized groups, women, people of color, and LGBT people, when they attain a certain set of rights, there's a tendency, kind of an impulse to try to fit in and be team players, show that you're just like the dominant group, which is white men, white straight men. And he came at it as the point of view, from the point of view of a person of color, an Asian person, Asian American person, and also as a gay man. And with regard to gay people, he said, you know, there's kind of ex-gay conversion therapy, and we've all agreed that's a bad thing. There's passing, which is the closet. We've all agreed that that's damaging to people psychologically. But covering, we're still grappling with, you know, once you're out of the closet, do you downplay being gay or not? And I argue and take his book and I apply it to everything, popular culture, everything. There's covering on TV. There's covering in our own lives. There's covering in the media. It's reached its limit. We can't get any further unless we focus on our difference. And one big difference is our intimacy and how we engage. And the polls will show people do not want to see gay people kissing because that.
Even on TV or
yes,
in the movies.
And so a lot of TV has accommodated to that. But that is the only way we're going to really break through that deep-seated homophobia and challenge people.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Michelangelo Signorelli, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of a book called It's Not Over. We want to hear from you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We do have some comments I want to read. Send them to radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave it on our Facebook page as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Michelangelo Signorelli. He's editor-at-large of Huffington Post Gay Voices, host of the Michelangelo Signorelli Show on Sirius XM Progress, and author of a new book called It's Not Over. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me pick up on the covering point that you were making, which is, I mean, I think it is true if you look at TV, for instance, there are more gay characters. But you're saying acting in kind of limited roles. We only see a part of their lives.
Yes. I mean, we certainly have the exceptions, and people like to point to the exceptions, but they are the exceptions rather than the rule. Certainly looking at Orange is the New Black and Laverne Cox, just such a groundbreaker as a transgender actress playing a transgender character. We had Looking on HBO, Gay Men's Lives. But these are niche channels, and they often don't last, these shows. On broadcast TV, we see gay people like on Modern Family who are, you know, nice, funny neighbors, good parents, but have no sexual chemistry whatsoever. Mm-hmm. While the straight couple is, you know, every year they have to celebrate their anniversary, they go to a hotel and have sex. And one episode, the kids walked in on them having sex. It was a really funny episode. Not the gay characters. And it's all about making them sort of harmless and sexless. And, you know, I talk about how it you saw this play out with Michael Sam, the football player, when he came out as gay and would become the first drafted openly gay player. He could have really assimilated in. He could have covered. He had a conventional masculinity. And that's another thing about covering. Gay people who don't fit the norm, you know, women who are a little butch, gay men who are effeminate, a lot of transgender people, you know, you can't cover. But Michael Sam certainly could have, you know, slipped right in, but he didn't. He decided to kiss his boyfriend on national television, like all of the other players kissed their girlfriends or wives. And that set off a five alarm fire in the media. And it showed how much of a threat that is, particularly to
although
men.
Although some of it was positive, don't you think?
Oh, yes.
Was just this big reaction.
There were those who were saying, hey, we shouldn't do this. But, you know, I talk about a lot of the implicit bias studies, and particularly straight men who are insecure about their masculinity. They don't want to see that. And that was the question to me the next day on CNN was, well, what about Michael Sam when he goes into the locker room now after he engage in that kiss? And I said, well, so what? What is it? They think he's going to kiss them? They know he's gay. I don't get it, right?
Let me read an email from Avi. He says, I'm quoting here, I have a full understanding and support for gays and lesbians and transgenders, but the current trend of identifying transgenders at an early age and beginning to change their gender, hormones and all, at an age when the child has no clue of the consequences of these changes offends me and ought to be stopped. That's his comment. I mean, these are really poignant and, I think, difficult decisions that families make with their young children. But in many ways, I think trying to be a loving parent to a child who is identifying in different kinds of ways.
Well, we all often know, those of us who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, that we are that way from a very young age. Now, some really don't. Some gay men I know didn't realize it until they were in their 20s. I certainly knew when I was 8 years old. And if my parents if I could have communicated that and they could have accepted that, what an amazing thing that would be, instead of me struggling to try to be something else and play with these toys and try to, because, you know, I think a lot of gay men, they think, well, they're confused because they don't quite relate to the other boys. And, you know, if somebody had an understanding of that, it would have been a great thing. And with a lot of transgender kids, they're coming to realize it at a young age. And I think parents who are responsible should simply let them come to terms with who they are. And what the writer is pointing to is kind of this idea out there in the right-wing media that there's something irresponsible about allowing the children to make that decision about themselves in terms of figuring out who they are. And I think the opposite is very dangerous when you don't go with it, when you say, no, you are going to dress this way. No, you are going to do this. You're already creating that hostile environment for that kid. And it gets back to the suicide rates.
Well, and I also think, and probably a lot of this is very unconscious, is that we, you know, if you see someone with a dog, what's the first question you ask? Is it a boy or is it a girl? I mean,
right.
It is a way that we, rightly or wrongly, orient ourselves to another person thinking that they are of a certain gender or of a certain sex.
Yes. And, you know, I talk about it, and I know it's kind of utopian, but if we're really going to get to a point where we have full acceptance, it means revolutionizing education, and it means revolutionizing our lives and not giving boys the blue clothes or the babies the blue and the girls the pink, because they're not all going to fit that, and they're going to have to break out of a closet then. Why create the closet from the beginning?
Let me read a Facebook comment from Jay. He says, it sounds ironic, but I suspect the AIDS crisis gave us both today's gay rights movement and the current wave of medical marijuana reform. The HIV/AIDS community should own that a bit more. In my opinion, does your guest agree that AIDS provided the springboard to all this meteoric progress?
I agree 100%. The irony and the tragedy is we didn't cure AIDS, and we still have HIV infection rates that are the same as they were. We did develop drugs that are keeping people alive, and that's a great thing, but we still haven't developed a vaccine or a cure. But there's no question that within the gay movement, the DNA of ACT UP and the AIDS activist movement is there in everything. We wouldn't have marriage. We wouldn't have any of these things if not for the push for people to be visible and the demand that we be treated as human beings and as equal people. And on the medical marijuana, I think very much true as well, because AIDS paved the way in terms of the activist movement for I think certainly medical marijuana was used for a lot of people with AIDS, but also cancer drugs. We stopped the crazy 5-year drug approval process for people who are suffering from illnesses. AIDS activists did that and saved a lot of people beyond people with HIV.
There was a very good documentary about that.
Yes, How to Survive a Plague.
Let me get, looks like David from Newark, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just had a question for the speaker. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a transgender roommate. She's male to female. And something happened today that it kind of took me off guard. I took her to a job interview. And I noticed when I was taking her to the job interview that she was dressed as a male, and she was presenting her resume with her male birth name. And I want to know if you've heard of any cases of this before, or if there's something that I can do or that she can do to boost her confidence when she goes into a job interview and to say, hey, they're going to hire me because of my credentials, not because of my sexuality.
Well, David, thanks. Yeah.
If you are saying that she is male to female, that she identifies as she, it sounds like she is not fully transitioned,
right,
if she is still out there in the world presenting as a male. And I think you have to leave it to her to make that decision. But I think what you point to is the enormous struggle that transgender people go through. And just the idea of getting a job, really extraordinary. And, you know, I have interviews in the book with some transgender people who, when they transitioned on the job, you know, they were demoted, or, you know, if they worked in retail, put in the back room, we don't want people to see you, or fired. It's an enormous struggle for them, and I think it's something we all really need to understand.
Let me read a tweet from Sheena saying, the media represents the way the gay rights movement is racist. Please speak to racism in the movement. Can you address the fact that racism in the gay movement is why it's at odds with the civil rights movement? Do you think there's racism within the gay movement?
Absolutely. There's racism everywhere. And there's racism among gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender activists. We need to challenge ourselves around these issues. We need to challenge ourselves in terms of who's in the leadership of the LGBT movement, and making sure that people of color are not just represented, but are in the decision-making process. And then when we critique the media and groups like LAD, it's their role to do that. We need to look at how the media represents us as white and diminishes those people of color. I think we're seeing a difference with shows like Empire and others. But yeah, it is something we really need to address more and really try to help change.
Comment from Kristen says, I'm a caterer, recently catered a same-sex marriage. My issue with the baker example is that why would LGBT people even want to be served by someone who isn't comfortable with them? A bad relationship between businesses and consumers lead to a lesser quality product.
Well, every one of us, you know, I think when we look at that situation, go, why on earth would you want to go to a baker who doesn't want to bake a cake for you? For whatever reason,
of course,
right? And you can understand that. I think if you live in a city where there are, you know, 25 bakers within a 5-mile radius, that's an easy decision to make. When you're in a small town, and this I hear from every day on my show, because it goes far beyond the cities to rural areas, Sometimes there's one baker. Sometimes there's one wedding planner. Sometimes there's one place to have your wedding reception. And the next one is 80 miles away. And guess what? They sort of have the same attitudes there. And 80 miles past that, they sort of have the same attitudes there. I mean, you can't allow for it, you know, even with this idea of, oh, well, go to somebody else. Sometimes there isn't somebody to go to. But also, even if there was somebody else to go to, why should you have to?
Do you think that the president, this would be President Obama, was truly evolving on this issue of gay equality, or he just was sort of waiting for the right moment to perhaps out his own self?
You know, this has been like the mystery of the ages, President Obama's position on gay marriage, because, of course, he did fill out that questionnaire back in the 90s saying he did support it. But then they said, oh, no, he didn't mean that. And then he said that, you know, he both thought it was between a man and a woman. And then he said he was evolving. But now David Axelrod says, no, he always supported it. I think that he, like a lot of other politicians, was trying to finesse this issue and do it in a way that was most advantageous to him. And I think that whatever was the reality, it sort of doesn't matter. It's what he says publicly. But what he said publicly happened only because of the pressure that was put on him by LGBT activists and people.
And the vice president.
And the vice president and others around him. But we really saw activism. And I talk a lot about this in the book. You have to confront. People were interrupting his speeches. People on Don't Ask, Don't Tell were chaining themselves to the White House gate. Let's not forget he started out defending DOMA in court. That took activists to push him to change.
I'd forgotten this, but Dan Savage, you include this in your book, had a T-shirt at some rally that said, evolve already.
That's right, yes. when he went to the – I think it was – he actually went to the White House for a reception and wore that button.
What do you make of the fact – and there was an article recently, I guess it was the New York Times or some paper about Republicans struggling to sort of figure out whether they would – go to a gay marriage, or if they had a friend who was gay and got married, that maybe they would go to the reception, but they wouldn't go to the ceremony. What do you make of that?
Republicans are in a terrible quandary, and it's of their own making for, you know, bringing religious conservatives so into their party and allowing them to have such a grip on the party. The poll out today from Washington Post ABC showing the highest support we've seen to date for marriage equality, 58%. But among Republicans, six out of 10 Republicans are opposed to marriage equality. Among those who identify themselves as conservative Republicans, 71% are opposed to marriage equality. So Republicans have this horrendous dance they have to do with, you know, placating and supporting those people and then getting out into a general election and having an electorate that's totally fine with this. And so that's what you're seeing here. Oh, I would go to a reception, but not to the service. Oh, I wasn't going to go, but then my wife said we should go. It's all trying to show that we're struggling too, but we're not quite there. I don't think that placates the religious conservatives one bit, and I think we're going to see them pressured to really have a very hard and fast position.
Your book is dedicated to someone named Sarah Pettit. Who's Sarah Pettit?
Sarah Pettit is a really just an enormous figure in LGBT journalism. She was a editor at Outweek magazine, where I was an editor and was a dear friend of mine. And she died at a young age from cancer and had really been just such a fighter for equality for LGBT people. And the National Gay and Lesbian Journalists Association has every year the Sarah Pettit Award for LGBT journalism. She was a good friend, and I wanted to dedicate this to her.
We're almost out of time here, but as I said, you have a radio show on Sirius XM. What do you like about radio?
Enormous intimacy with people all across the country, and honesty, and people able to really sort of tell you whether it is something you agree with or disagree, what they really feel. And I think that kind of gives you the ability to kind of reach people in ways that you're not reaching them in other media. I love that.
I mean, the intimacy, because in a way, you can't see them? I mean, does that almost create a deeper intimacy? It's a voice, right?
Yes. It provides that ability for people. Being visual is so sort of difficult, I think, for people. But when they cannot be seen, they can be more intimate. And, you know, a comment on an internet blog is just so flat. You can't get the inflections of people's voices or get their thoughts or the way you can when you hear them.
Well, Michelangelo Signorelli, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And the book is called It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. And again, he's editor-at-large at Huffington Post, Gay Voices, host of the Michelangelo Signorelli Show on Sirius XM Progress Channel 127. And as I said earlier, you can hear Radio Times on the NPR Sirius XM channel, and that is 122. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.